Okay, this evening, as we get rolling, I'm not even paying attention to where you're at on the worksheets that I passed out back. It's been a while ago since we passed those out, so I'm not even looking at it. I've just been looking at my notes. But we're down under what on my sheet would be M. That'd be on the outline part of it. And number three, under M is David's family experienced penalty for David's actions with Bathsheba. Yes.
We didn't have any of that. Last week we went to the bottom and that was it.
Really? Okay. Look at that. I've got extra sheets in here. So let's pause and let's pass those out for those of you that want. 29. There we go. Okay. So I'll just let you pass those around. I didn't realize I hadn't passed them all out on the first night.
Ah, so here's
one. Okay. But we're down under number M, David's family and the problems they had. There were two points we looked at last week. One of them was David's house affected by incest, and then David's house experienced civil war. That brings us down in 2 Samuel. If you have your Bibles, turn to 2 Samuel chapter 20. I'm running through some of these things kind of like last week, and then we're going to sit on some other matters. But one of the first things that happens, remember the first part of David's life, it's not that David didn't have any challenges, but the first part of David's life, you really just see a great things happening. This last part of David's life, you see some good things, but you also see some problems that they're having to cope, that David's having to cope with. And one of them in 2 Samuel chapter 20 happens to be a rebellion within Israel, not within his family. Last week we looked at a rebellion within his family, a civil war being led by his son Absalom, brought about in part by David's own actions. So if you look in chapter 20 of 2 Samuel, now verse 1 it says, "Now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite." Who were the Benjaminites? Okay. Who was the...
I did some bad things.
Who was the... Oh, okay. I didn't even put that together right up the bat. A little slow there. Whose family... Who was a Benjamite? Who's famous so far? Saul. The family of Saul. Exactly. And that's going to be very important for what we're going to have in this next little bit here. It says, so we have this man, he was a Benjamite, and he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion in David, nor do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents." Now keep in mind, we did have this statement last week, and we find it here again. They've been in the land now for quite a few years. I mean, we're talking about over 100 years that they've been in the land. Saul reigned for 40 years. We're probably at this point maybe 20 years into David's reign. So 60 years that they've had kings, not to mention the nearly 400 years under the time of the judges that they were that were going on. So we've had a lot of time has passed. And yet they are still living in tents. And this was actually indicated in previous. We saw this last week in a verse. And there's a couple of verses that's indicating a lot of Israel is still living in tents. Probably to some degree because even though the tribes received land that was distributed then among the families of those individual tribes, these people also still are raising livestock. And... I'll use the Greens as an illustration of this. The Greens have livestock, and if you don't know what the Greens do with their livestock, they don't just pasture them on their little bit of pasture ground they have over there. They load them up on trucks, and they haul them way up, and they take them way up north of Grand Coulee and up into those areas, up around the Methow and stuff like that, and they run cattle up there. They take cattle over to Idaho, and they run cattle over in Idaho. In different places like that. So they're moving them around to find good pasture. You can't just pasture them in the same place all the time because they eat it down to nothing over time. Well, this is probably still going on with these people. They're still probably living in tents in part because they keep moving their cattle around, their livestock and their cattle. Livestock being that they were also raising sheep and goats in addition to cattle. So they're still living in tents, but I think that's an important point because it shows you that some of the people are living in cities. You and I don't perhaps appreciate the way cities work, the purpose of what a city was at their time. We think of a city as where a person just comes to live. But the purpose of cities back in the old culture was to actually build walls of fortification. And when you had battles with other people, you'd bring your livestock up into that area where the city was, and you'd have a lower wall that you could keep your cattle protected in, but you yourself and your family would resort within the larger fortified walls to wait out attacks. We don't do that. Can you imagine that every time there was a raider, Ed has to load the family up and get the cattle all there and has to all ride into Royal City and get inside the fort? But this is exactly what they did in their society that they were living in. And they weren't the only ones. The Philistines did this. All these people had fortified cities. In fact, when we looking at David's earlier life, when they were going about conquering, one of the things they were doing is they were conquering fortified cities. And that's the significance of a promise for the future from the book of Ezekiel, that there's a day coming in which these people will live in unwalled villages. You and I, that doesn't make a whole lot of difference to us because we don't think about living in a village with a wall around it. But they did because it was fortification against raids. And everybody raided back and forth. In fact, last week when David got into trouble with Bathsheba, the whole story is introduced. It says, and in the spring when the kings went out. In other words, it was just the normal course of life where they lived for kings to go out and enter into battle. They're always trying to stretch their territory. If you're not out there to defend yourself, this king over here is going to come and take your territory. But it's not that you're content with yours. You're always trying to take their territory too. And David does this during his kingdom. He expands the territory. The kingdom is the largest it ever will be during the time of the Old Testament under David. It was never that large before. And even under Solomon, it didn't expand beyond that. Solomon expanded trade, but he didn't expand the kingdom. But these people are still, a lot of the kingdom is still in tents. So just make this, every man to his tents, O Israel. Verse 2. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. And so David comes down. And this is shortly after the problem with Absalom. And so there's a statement here about what happened. It says, then David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep the house, placed them under guard, provided them with sustenance, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living like widows. So they never remade. He never from that point on treated them as wives. They were treated as widows. He kept his distance from them because, remember, his son Absalom had tried to disgrace his father by engaging in relations with his father's concubines. And remember what a concubine was. A concubine was a secondary wife. She was not a free woman. She was a woman that was purchased to be your wife versus somebody that you would go to a girl's father or a woman's father and say, I would like to marry your daughter. Here's the dower, or, you know, what's the dowry and what's the exchange and like that. Sort of a slave wife, yeah. Yeah, so they weren't, yeah. So concubines weren't considered free women as compared to, so they were always a secondary wife because they were a wife that you didn't have by arrangement, or they were a wife that you had because you purchased them primarily.
Can you imagine that because of all this war, I mean, the male to female ratio is probably pretty tilted?
Yeah, there's a good possibility it was.
Of course, you lost a lot of women to childbirth, so you had a high mortality rate in the women too, so.
Yeah. Prior to the last century with the advent of modern medicine, 60% of women died giving birth to children. The mortality rate of women was really high. Oh, it was horribly high. And the mortality rate for children was high. And I don't know how it was at this time. Israel didn't have this issue. But we were just talking about this in the Bible study yesterday morning. at the time the New Testament is written, the ratio of men to women in the Greek or in the Roman Empire, among Roman citizens, not the Jews, this was different among Jews, was 4 to 1. 4 men for every 1 woman. Because most families couldn't afford more than 2 children. So what happened when you have other children? If you had girls, you just took them out in the mountains and left them. And that you just let them die, see. And so as a result, they were kind of like China with the one-child policy. Pretty soon you've got all these males, but you don't have any women to marry, you know, because you've gotten rid of all the daughters, you know. And that happened during the New Testament time, okay. You guys don't have that problem. You guys have 3 girls, so. you're the other way around. You're 3 to 1, so. The concubines were, but the wives weren't. Remember, David has Bathsheba, which is regular wife. He has Abigail, which is wife. He has some other wives.
And there was no dowry.
There would have been a dowry. They weren't purchased wives. You didn't buy. You may have had to made an exchange or something with their dads, but you didn't buy them. So the other ones were a little bit closer to something like a slave. They weren't a slave, but they were something a little closer to that. They just weren't considered free. Anyway. Okay, so because we had a question about this last week, and we didn't get this far. We kind of got cut off, but we're wondering about what ends up happening, and this is where that matter's addressed. For the rest of the account of what goes on at this time, pretty soon, what ends up happening is you have Amasa, a brother to Joab, that comes and says, "Hey, you know we're or not Amasa? It's I didn't get his name right in here. It's Joab and whoever favors Joab. Maybe it is Abishai, that is. Abishai, down in verse 10. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother. There it is. Amasa is the man that Joab kills, okay? Comes up and says, "How are you doing?" Grabs him by the beard and pulls him down and runs him through with a sword that he doesn't see to get revenge on him for what he's been doing. But Abishai then cries out and says, "Whoever's loyal to David, follow us." And the people go on and they follow. They put a city under siege. There's a wise woman that comes and says, "Hey, why should the whole city perish because we got one idiot in here?" And so they take the guy's head, cut it off, throw the head down to him, and the battle's over. And thus ends, Sheba, the son of Bichri, ends this rebellion. And once the leader's gone, the people give up. So that happens. So God actually looks out for David and David's kingdom through these other individuals, Abishai and Joab, that kind of step up to help out. That brings us down to chapter 21. Chapter 21, it says, "And there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year." This is one of those statements now that we've been trying to help you pay attention to as you go through there. "And David sought the presence of the Lord." We hear people use this expression today. Say, I want to seek the Lord's face. I want to seek his presence. And we don't know what that means. And it doesn't even fit for us today. Because what it meant at that time was to seek where God was. And God was in the tabernacle. So it meant to seek where God was. It's not an expression to seek God's face or to seek his presence. It's not an expression meaning, I just really am sincere. When people say, "I just seek the God's face." They're taking something out of the Old Testament. They're giving a whole new connotation to it of this sincerity. I'm just really seeking God's face. And that's not what it meant. What was meant by this was that this person said, "God told me he's at the tabernacle. If I want him, I don't come out and pray towards this hill or towards this rock or towards this tree like everybody else did. I went and I sought God's presence at that tabernacle. That's where he's at, and that's where I went and addressed my communication." And so it says, David then sought the presence of the Lord or the face of the Lord. He wants to go to the tabernacle and talk to God there. But this is important. Because this is the very thing that Saul didn't do until later in his life, after he'd already got himself cut off because he had made foolish choices early on. David, as we've tried to point out, not all the time, but regularly, when he's faced problems, has turned to God. I honestly would say it is one of the lessons we can learn from David that we ought to do. Now, we don't seek God by going to a temple. We know where God's at. He's in the third heaven, and we have access to him because his son sits at his right hand, and we are seated in the sun. But what David did in going to the Lord, and then it says, David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, it is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. We ought to be those that, when he's seeking, go to God and say, God, what should I do? How do you want me to respond? We really need to take that seriously. Because all too often, we're like Israel earlier when we were under the conquest under Joshua, where we're more like the Gibeonites coming. We're going, I don't need to talk to God. I don't need to ask God. It's really obvious. These people are poor. They're impoverished. They've got nothing going for them. So, you know, hey, yeah, we'll make a treaty with you. And we tend to do that. We tend to look at everything and think it's an easy decision. A, B, C. But God doesn't always work A, B, C. Sometimes God's A, B, and I want you to go over there. And you're going, what? God says, I want you to do that. You have that in the Word of God. We saw that even with David, where the one time David says, should we go out against these people to battle? Remember, we saw this back, it's been probably a month ago now. And he says, should we go out? God goes, yeah, go out against them. Okay, then another battle with the Philistines again. David this time comes and says, should we go out against them? And God goes, no, don't go out against them. I want you to go around back around to the side this time. And God defeated the people, and then they were involved in that afterwards. So sometimes God's plans aren't, God could change the way he's doing something. Anyway, I think that this is very important as this comes, that he comes and asks about what should we do. This is what he's looking for. God tells him, now this is the one thing you're not going to get today, is you're not going to get God coming and telling you with an audible voice. And we don't know when we read verse 1 whether God audibly spoke to David personally, or is more likely the case that he spoke through David's prophet. David had a prophet that worked through the temple, and that prophet frequently spoke to David about matters. Such as Nathan was the one with regard to Bathsheba. It's more likely that that's what took place, although God could have spoken directly to David, but usually he spoke through a prophet. Verse 2, so the king called the Gibeonites. Remember, these are the people, we just made reference to them back in Joshua. They'd made a treaty with these people foolishly because they didn't talk to God about whether they should do it, and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you? How can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And the Gibeonites said to him, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. And he said, well, I will do for you whatever you say. So they said to the king, okay, the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining with any border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us. We will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give. And the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. And so they go and they take these 7 sons of Saul, these 7 descendants, we should say, of Saul, and they put them to death. And thus ends the drought that they're having at that time that's causing them to have these problems. So he's making reparations for what transpired in the past. Now we move on down here in this chapter. And let's go to verse 15. And it says, and when the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David went down and his servants with him. And as they fought against them, the Philistines, David became weary. So we have a change now. This happens, sadly. I don't know how to tell some of you younger guys this, but eventually the day's going to come where you're going to all of a sudden be doing something and going, wow, I used to do that and that wasn't that hard. And all of a sudden now that's a bit of a chore. or I can't get up off the ground as easily as I once did, you know. And this is what David finds out. David, this strong warrior that has fought these battles for these many years, all of a sudden now he's learning what it is to really get tired, weary. Then Ishbi-benob, who was among the descendants of the giant, the Rephaim, okay, and we've looked elsewhere. Remember, the Rephaim were part of the Nephilim, and the Nephilim were men of stature. Tells us that in Deuteronomy. So these were big guys, okay? Giants, abnormal. They're not just tall human beings. These were people that were the product of what happened between women, women of Adam, and the sons of God. Sons of God meaning fallen spirit beings. This happened in Genesis, but it tells us they were in the earth in those days and also afterwards. This was repeated after the flood. And so these were in there. Remember when David, or not when David, but when Israel came in, was coming into the land in Deuteronomy, one of the people that they had to deal with in that land was, I'm drawing it blank, Og, king of Bashan. And Og, king of Bashan, it says, remember, he had a bed that was, if I remember correctly, 13 feet long. What do you have a 13-foot long bed for? Because you're a man that's probably 12 and a half. And you need to have a little room. You don't want your head bumping the one end and your feet bumping the other, if you got a footboard on there. So this is a real tall, that's taller than Goliath, remember? Goliath's about 9 and a half. That guy, Og, king of Bashan, was over 12 feet tall, probably, since he's got such a big bed. Maybe just 12, but it doesn't say. Anyway, it says, this Ishbi-benob, who was among the descendants of the Rephaim, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels. Did I put down the weight of his spear? I didn't. I actually looked it up, but I do not recall what it was. Maybe some of you have a modern translation that tells you how much 300 shekels is, but it's not. It's not light, okay, for a spear. And remember what a spear is, the difference between a spear and a javelin. You don't throw a spear. A spear is a short sword on the end of a stick so I can get Jim from over here without having to get in close enough for him to get at me with his sword. That's what a spear was. So that means it's something you're carrying all the time. You're carrying it and you're thrusting it out there a lot. It takes a lot of muscle to throw, you know. You can carry something a little while. It'd be hard to throw, too. But it would be hard to keep that underneath there and keep thrusting that at people. So not only is he tall, but he's strong. Again, that's different than most people today that have what you might call giantism today. Almost all individuals today that have giantism, almost all of them have severe physical deformities and very weak skeletal systems. They have a lot of physical problems. Okay. So he goes on from here and he says the weight of his spear was 300 shekels, bronze in weight, was girded with a new sword, most likely, and he intended to kill David. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. And then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You will not go out with us to battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel." So he looks at this and he says, "David, man, if you're the king, if you go out, you fall in war. What is that going to do to the people? I mean, you've been like this mighty warrior since you were probably 20 years of age, and you first started fighting for Saul." And so he says, "No, David, they're going to tell him. They're not going to let him go out." And now it came about after this that there was a war against the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the Rephaim. And there was a war with the Philistines again at Gob. And Elhanah, the son of Jir Oregim, if I'm butchering these pronunciations, I apologize. Again, the Bethlehemite killed Goliath, probably literally the one of Goliath or one related to Goliath. Although Goliath may be a family name, that may not have been his first name. So it'd be like he killed the Holsher. Except in my family, there was only one guy. You know, I had sisters. So
mine has a sexual land leader brother of Goliath.
Yeah. See, and that's because the Septuagint, the Greek translation, adds that. That's not the Hebrew. That's the way in Greek they translated it. And we don't know if they did that for clarification or if the Hebrew text that they were reading when they translated actually had the words there. But we don't have those words in a Hebrew text.
How about the NIV has Rapha with
That's fine. Raphaim is just, yeah, was just a plural version of Rapha. Yeah.
But that's significant. I mean, that's fallen angel.
But that is what it's referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I like it. Okay. So, the Raphaim and the Nephilim are what?
Both the words means those that have fallen. Nephilim literally means those that have fallen, and Rapha means those that are bowed low. So both of them, they were ideas that they weren't from God's, I think they're called that because from God's point of view, they weren't normal. So they were actually, even though mankind looked at them as great, remember in Genesis it said the Nephilim were men of a name, men of fame. They were famous guys, just like, you know, you got all-star athletes today. They're really famous individuals. These guys were really famous. But God looked at them and said, they're not famous. You know what they are? They're fallen ones. That's what these people are. They're low ones. That's what they are. That's the way God describes these individuals. Okay.
How would you spell Raphaim?
R-E-P-H... A-I-M? Okay. Okay, I was just trying to see if there was another H in there in my head, so thank you.
I'm not killing
the meat. So we're picking up again at the end of verse 19. It says, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, again, really big. And there was a war at Gath, again, so they continue to have these wars with the Philistines, where there was, a man of stature, who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in number, and he also was born literally to the giant or to the Rapha, to the, among these fallen ones, these low ones. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. Verse 22. These four were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants, indicating. Do you remember when David goes to the brook? We saw that picture of the valley. And when he goes down into that brook and he picks up five stones. Now, this is a guess. This is all this is. You can't base doctrine on this. But what you find out here is that there are four other guys from Gath. They all are brothers. And they're tied to Goliath. So you got five brothers in all. And I've heard more than once, I've heard people suggest, did David expect to fling all five of those stones at Goliath, or was he thinking, I may have to fight off his four brothers too? I don't know. But I could see that David would do that, because remember when David says, somebody's got to do something with these uncircumcised Philistines, it challenges the God of Israel. He's really concerned for the sake of God's name, God's character, and when he takes this on. But the result of this is, even though you have now all five of these giants from Gath, all five of them are exterminated over successive wars in Gath. You get down to the end of this here, and David no longer is going to be going out to war. He's reached the stage in which it's time when Israel goes to war. It's time for David to stay home. Okay, so David's going to stay home. There is a psalm here that David records. It's recorded both here as well as in the book of Psalms. And then if you go over to chapter 24 here in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 24. And by the way, I just throw out one more thing about the issue with Goliath's brother and such. That's one of the long list of Bible contradictions that people will list, saying, well, 1 Samuel says that David killed Goliath, but over here it says that Elhanah, the son of Jair-Oregim, he's the one that killed Goliath. Because the Hebrew text does read that. But there is the very real possibility that, like I said, Goliath could be the family name. It can also be that Goliath is in what we call the construct form in Hebrew. And construct is not always a form, a specific form it's identifiable. Sometimes it is. But it could just mean one related to Goliath. You have a lot of those actually in Hebrew. So there's a couple of possibilities. One way or another, there's no Bible contradiction here. David killed somebody quite a few years earlier before he even had become a warrior, technically. This time, however, This is somebody else that kills at a time when David is weak, and it's not Goliath. It's not the one that David killed. It's another one of the four. Okay, just pointing that out. It is one of those things people toss out as a Bible contradiction. Okay, chapter 24 then. It says, "And now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah." Now, I remember a couple of years ago, Andrew and Denali were reading through the Bible, and they came to me and they said, "Hey, we got a problem. Why did God in his anger incite David to do this?" The answer to this, if you flip over to 1 Chronicles, keep your place here. Turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 21. Okay. 1 Chronicles 21 and verse 1, it says, and I'm reading the New American Standard, and we're going to explain a couple things about this. It says in verse 1, "Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel." And so we have this happen in here, and this gives rise to what we have over in 2 Samuel. Now let's talk about this passage here for a little bit. The Hebrew word Satan means adversary. It can mean a physical adversary. It can refer to Satan, the adversary. We have that in Job. It says that the sons of God came before God, and Satan, the adversary, one that isn't in a good relationship with God, he also comes among them. And we have that twice in the first two chapters of Job. Same word, same Hebrew word here. So you always have to kind of read and determine by context. Now, I've listened to people that have argued that this is not the adversary, ha-satan, it's just Satan, just an adversary. Therefore, it can't be Satan, which I would say, that's not necessarily true. This can be Satan, and it can be Satan because what happens here, it says, and Satan stood up against Israel and moved or incited David to number the people. Now, what some people have said by trying to say, well, this is not Satan, this is the enemy. David sees the enemy out there, the adversaries, Philistines, whoever they might be, they so irritate and so cause David to be worried that David then decides, we need to take a census. Now, the reason they're taking a census, by the way, is for military purposes, right? This isn't a taxation census. This is a census to see how many able-bodied young men do we have that we can conscript for war. That's what David is doing. But I do not have a problem with the fact that this can be Satan himself, because one of the things that Satan does persistently as a means of temptation is he causes, encourages us to worry. He uses something out there to cause us to be afraid of our circumstances. So what do we do when we get afraid of circumstances? We turn to God and say, God, I don't know what to do with this. I'm freaked out. I need help. No, what we tend to do is the same kind of thing David did. We make plans. How can I fix this situation so I don't have to be afraid of this? What can I do to fix it? And if you've listened to Ed's testimonies in church, you find out a lot of times you end up grinding your nose against things, don't you? We've all been there, and Ed's been bold enough to share with us some of those experiences, and the rest of us have done it too. We've tried to fix the thing only to find out we're fighting against something that isn't the way. We're trying to do something that's not what God intended for us to do. God's got a completely different plan. And the whole reason that we're afraid is because he's got something out there. He's letting us go through that because he wants us to see how he's going to take us through in a way that we would never imagine and put something together in such a way. This situation happens here. Satan, I can see very easily, he may use the enemies. He may use David's weakened condition, his inability to now lead the people in war. He may use those things to cause David to worry and to be afraid and to then get David saying, oh, the solution, number the people. Let's find out how many able-bodied men we have. That then results in what we have. If you flip back over to 2 Samuel 24, this takes us back to what happened over here in verse 1. And so when we read and I'm going to read again New American Standard here, the way they've translated. It says, now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. And then it says, and it incited. But it doesn't actually say that it was God's anger that incited. That's not the way the Hebrew reads. It says, because David was incited against them to say, go number Israel to Israel and Judah. What this is telling you, if you combine this with the passage in 1 Chronicles is telling you why David numbered the people. He did it because he was, shall we say, under a satanic attack. It's because he succumbed to the satanic attack, because he did what Satan wanted him to do and acted out of fear and went and numbered the people, that God's anger burned. Now, why did God's anger burn against this? Let's take a look at a couple passages. Turn with me to Psalm chapter 20. Psalm 20. In fact, I think there's a song I haven't heard it a lot, but used to hear this on some of the Christian radio stations. But Psalm 20 in verse 7 says, some boast, some trust. There's a trying to make sense out of what they're doing here, but some have their confidence. Well, let's go back to verse 6 and you kind of see this. Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from holy heaven with the saving strength in his right hand. In other words, some of them really know God's going to do that. But, verse 7, but some, rather than resorting to God's strong arm, some trust in chariots and some in horses. But we will boast or trust in the name of the Lord our God. In other words, some are going to say, hey, I got enough army? We're good. Whereas there's others that they're going to put their confidence in God to do that. What's the problem with numbering the people for David? He's supposed to put his confidence in God. He has in the past. But, like, sadly, hopefully not you as too often, but I'm going to tend to say if you're kind of like me, probably you get yourself caught a little too often finding that you put a little bit too much confidence in your ability to try to make a thing work or try to happen, only to have to, and you might only get started in it and then go, wait a second, what am I doing? And backpedal out of it and say, okay, God, my hands are off this. You, I want to see what you're going to do here. But we don't always do that right away. Turn with me over to Isaiah 31. Isaiah 31. And this is just a sample of texts that warn Israel about doing exactly what they do here. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help. If you read the historical books, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, you find instances in which the kings of Israel make an alliance with, well, when Judah and Israel are split, they make alliance together. And then one of them makes an alliance with Egypt for war. For help, and then maybe one of them makes an alliance with Assyria or Babylon for a little while. And they're always running off trying to say, you know, the solution here is to align myself with other people of power. But he says, woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord. Deuteronomy. Chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16. Verse 14 says, but when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, the one from among your countrymen. You shall set as a king over yourselves. You shall not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, you shall not, he shall not multiply horses for himself. What's the purpose of multiplying horses? For warfare. Okay. For getting around, did they use horses for getting around? What did they use for getting around? What? Donkeys and mules. Yeah. In fact, we had one of the guys, one of the judges, remember, it says he had, what, 70 donkeys and had all of his sons, and they all rode on donkeys. So that was luxury. Just riding, you didn't have to walk on your feet. You all got to ride on the donkey. We think that made this sound very honoring to us, but it was a really big deal to ride on a donkey. Which, by the way, I was just talking to Peg about this. I was wondering, we come into the season, where the tradition developed, because I can't find it in Scripture, that Mary arrived in Bethlehem riding on a donkey. Number one, if I were a woman that was 9 months pregnant, I don't know if I'd want to be on a beast that's going like this. Not that I would. I can't relate to you women. Pardon me. I'm not trying to compare myself. But I can't imagine walking that distance either from Nazareth all the way to, one way or another, it had to be rough. I think probably the reason that she came, that they always have her coming in with Joseph leading a donkey, probably was because riding on a donkey actually was a noble thing. But I don't know that for sure. It's just my guess, because I always wonder why they have that. Anyway, but he shall not multiply horses for himself. Those were for warfare because they were fast. Nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Don't go back there. We just saw that statement in Isaiah. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. And then it also says you shall not multiply wives for yourself, which we've had two kings so far that have already done that, mostly David. Lest his heart turn away, nor shall he increase silver and gold for himself, which also is going to happen, especially when we get with Solomon. But the purpose in this, if we go back over there to 2 Samuel 24, the significance of this problem, the purpose of looking at these texts was to remind ourselves, why was God angry? He's angry because, connected with 1 Chronicles, that Satan moved David to number the people. It causes God to be angry because they were not to put their trust in military warfare. They were not to put their trust in how large their army was. How many examples do you have to look at of Israel being able to go out to war, sometimes against rather formidable forces? Gideon, what did God do with Gideon? Whittles the number of men that are going to go down to a very small armed force. I listened to one guy that tried to, what he was doing was he was trying to find the guys that would fight like Navy SEAL. It wasn't that at all. It was actually because God wanted to show I'm the one that's going to win the battle, not because you have overwhelming odds in your favor. In fact, we've seen times when Israel tried to go to battle with huge forces and they were defeated exactly because they were putting their trust in the wrong thing in there. Best battle of all, I still always think, is the one with Hezekiah. I was actually working on that a couple weeks ago for this study, where Sennacherib comes down from the north and puts Jerusalem under siege. And God himself, after Hezekiah seeks God at the temple, God himself walks through the camp of the Assyrians and kills 185,000 men in one night all by himself, which actually isn't a big deal. He could just like that and it'd be done. But it says that he does this, and it says in verse 2, and the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, this is 2 Samuel 24:2, go about now through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, register the people that I may know the number of the people. And he does this. Let's see. Okay. I should have my notes better than this. Verse 10. Now David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the perversity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly. And as a result, God actually provides three options for what David's going to do. David chooses the one, how can we handle, let's see what he says. Verse 13, so Gad came to David and told him and said, shall 7 years of famine come to your land, or will you flee 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you, or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? See, now most of us look at that and go, wow, 7 years famine, being chased by your enemies for, what did it say, 3 months? Or 3 days pestilence. Well, 3 days pestilence, that doesn't sound too bad. Although, see, you and I don't understand. Sometimes when you're talking about pestilence, you're talking about disease. And there's parts of the world. I saw this. I don't know if any of you else have seen this, but the Ebola thing that's going over there. I saw a chart of diseases that have been recorded in history. And on a chart where you have diseases that are like this, numbered in terms of the number of people that have been affected by it in history. Ebola virus, right now in Africa, it's like that on that chart. There have been diseases that have, well, like the Black Plague itself. How many people were wiped out in Europe through the Black Plague? It just decimated the population. So I'm not trying to make small thing of the Ebola virus at all. I'm just saying that thing right there, that just really freaks everybody out. Can you imagine what it was like? God could bring something so devastating that it could wipe out a large number of the population in the space of 3 days. But even though this is what God chooses, God in the end chooses to be merciful. Verse 14, then David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. So the Lord set pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time. 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba. That's a lot of people to die in 3 days' time from pestilence. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented. So he was going to actually wipe out Jerusalem where David is located. He's going to wipe that city out. But the Lord relented. He actually rests back from what he intended to do in this matter. Now he does it of himself, kind of like what Jim was going over with this last year. That kind of an idea. It's not doing it because he's going, oh, I was pressed to relent. No, it's part of his own will.
So is this God the Son?
God's the Son. Which would be interesting. He's the one that actually wages war. He's the one that'll come back and wage war at the second coming when the sword goes out of his mouth. So it would be consistent also. And so he relented. The angel, in the middle of verse 16, said to the angel who destroyed the people, it is enough, now relax your hand. And the angel of Jehovah, God the Son, was by the threshing floor of Aruna, the Jebusite. And David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel was striking down the people and said, behold, it is I who have sinned and it is I who have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. So Gad came to David that day and said to him, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Aruna, the Jebusite. David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded. And Aruna looked down, saw the king and his servants crossing over towards him. And Aruna went out, bowed his face to the ground before the king. And then Aruna said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back from the people. Aruna said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, the yokes of oxen for the wood, everything, O king. Aruna gives to the king, and Aruna said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. However, the king said to Aruna, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offering to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. David built there an altar to the Lord, offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and thus the Lord was moved by entreaty for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Again, early on in this study, we saw that David, when God was choosing David, he says, I'm looking for a man who is after my own heart, who has the kind of perspective I have. And different than Saul, who comes and says, oh, he gets into a problem that he does, and he says, it was the people. David comes into this, he initially kind of, I don't want to fall into the hands of man. And then he relents and he comes and he says, God, no, I'm the one. Take it out on me. Don't take it out on the sheep. Sheep obviously meaning the people. So again, I think another demonstration of the kind of character that actually was within David, even though we'd say it would have been better not to have gotten problem in that situation in the first place. You know what? All of us can say that. All of us can say we've made a choice somewhere along the line. We got ourselves into something that we wish after the fact we never would have even started. But after you're there and you recognize that you're in it, what's the right thing to do? Like David, recognize, admit your complicity in it. Recognize your guilt. Don't try to make excuses saying, well, I did it because of this or I did it because of that. That was Saul's way of handling it. David's way of handling it is to say, listen, I did this. Again, parallel for you and I, 1 John 1:9. You confess your sins. You don't make excuses for him. You don't sit. God doesn't want you to come and say, I did it because, and this reason, and then this reason, and so I know it was wrong, but I had some good reasons for it. That's not what confession is. Confession is coming and you and agreeing, you said this is not what I was supposed to do, and I did it anyway. That's what it is. And that's what David, that's really, to some degree, kind of the attitude that David has. It's not absolutely parallel, but again, I think it kind of shows us something else that kind of helps us with that. Okay.
What had David done in that? I missed what he had done to sin.
He numbered the people. He called for a census.
The Lord asked for that earlier in the chapter?
No. No.
Again, verse 1. Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go and take a census of Israel.
Okay. Yeah, we explained that. You might have just missed that part in there. What we saw was, if you compare this with the First Chronicles, it's Satan, it's the adversary that actually incites David to do this. It's God's anger burns against David. And then it says, and it's not in the Hebrew, there's not a direct connection that forces you to say that it was God's anger that incited him. It doesn't say that. It's connecting it with, more likely, the adversary is actually what it was.
What was that verse? Where was that in the verse?
1 Chronicles 21:1.
So when my NIV says, and he incited David against them, saying, go take a census of Israel and Judah.
Right. And the NASB actually translates it, and it incited. But the idea is that the incitation is not from God's anger. Okay.
Okay, that was 1 Chronicles
21:1. Probably, if you look in your margin, they probably have that verse noted there as a parallel.
1 Chronicles 27:23.
Oh, okay. I don't know what that one is, but we'll take a look at that. 27:23. Oh, it's talking about David did not count those 20 years of age and under, because the Lord had said he would multiply Israel as the stars of the heaven. So it's another.
So basically saying that because he counted, he was not trusting God, is that what the sin was?
Yes, yeah. And so that's why we looked at the passage in Psalms and in Isaiah and in Deuteronomy that warned against putting your trust or your confidence in your armed forces, to be able to say, hey, we're going to put our confidence in horses and chariots and such. And the king was not to do that. The king was not to multiply an army for himself. Right. God said that.
This gives us a good indication of population size, because he had 1.3 million able bodies, so they weren't under 20. Between 20 and 50s. Pretty big population.
Yeah. It is.
So is it grace or mercy that he doesn't do this all the time that David messes up? Because it just seems like, okay, he does this one thing, counting the population, the many wives, or Bathsheba, or even Saul, or we go on to Solomon. Why don't we see this before?
It actually specifically said in this context that God had mercy on him. He actually showed mercy to him. And the word for mercy, the interesting enough, the word for mercy literally means that God was soft. God was tender or soft to him. So this is interesting. The word for mercy is in the Hebrew, it's the same word. The noun form is the same word for womb. Womb and mercy are the same word. The idea had to be soft, caring, and gentle. So that was kind of the idea of what God did when he showed mercy. So that's what it says that he did in this instance. So, okay, next week we're going to come back and we want to look at a couple of psalms that David wrote.
No, we're not.
Oh, no. Next week is Christmas Eve and you'll all be doing something else. I'm going to be in Walla Walla, I think, so if everything works out. Well, you know, barring something happening, we're planning to be there, let's put it that way. 17th day, right? So we'll do this study at New Year's Eve party at the... So while everybody else is playing games, I'll be going doing this study up in the the office at the front of Orse or something like that, maybe. And we'll see who's serious and sincere, or who just wants to play the game. No. So in a couple weeks it'll be. We'll be back. Oh, okay. Well, I don't know where we'll do it then. No. Okay, let's have a word of prayer. Father, we're thankful for the time you've given us together. We're thankful for all of your word, those parts that are directly written to us and about your plans for us, and those parts that describe what you've done in other people's lives, such as David. We're thankful for the ability to read it and recognize your mercy and to be able to recognize the kind of attitude that David had properly at times realize that though his life isn't directly parallel to ours, it sometimes does show us the kind of attitude you would desire in people towards others. And we thank you for this. Amen.